England to rule the Empire. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply. Nathan Mayer Rothschild, 1815. Rhodes traveled back and forth from South Africa to England until the time of his graduation from Oxford in 1881. By then, he had acquired claims to over 40 diamond mines in Kimberley. Throughout the next 7 years, he continued to purchase mine after mine. Unfortunately, Rhodes ignored safety rules and disaster struck in March 1888, when one of his most profitable mines collapsed and 178 African laborers and 24 white miners perished. After the disaster, he returned to London to seek funding from N.M. Rothschild and Sons for the takeover of the remaining mines in Kimberley, including Compagnie Française, a company that owned a multitude of diamond-rich claims. Paper money. By the time of Rhodes's arrival, N.M. Rothschild and Sons, under Lord Nathan Rothschild, possessed complete control of the Bank of England, which regulated the country's currency. The Rothschilds performed this task simply by printing or burning the paper money. They increased the money supply to promote prosperity and decreased the supply to prevent inflation. These manipulations were based on the distinction between money and goods. Goods were the real wealth that a person possessed, while money remained only a person's claim on the wealth that was being retained by someone or something else, that is, a bank. Goods were tangible assets, while money represented a statement of the debt that was owed to the holder. The use of money rather than goods as payment for a transaction dated back to the creation of the Bank of England by William Paterson, a retired pirate, in 1694. Paterson alleviated his customers of the burden of transferring heavy bags or chests of gold for business transactions by producing paper certificates which entitled the bearers to exchange them for gold upon demand. Thanks to the convenience of paper, only a small fraction of certificate holders ever sought redemption in the precious metal. Paterson quickly realized that they only needed to keep enough gold in hand to cover the fraction of certificates presented as payment. The rest of the gold could be used to mount a myriad of public and private ventures, including the building of ships and the waging of war. The excess volume, which rose to 90% of the paper claims against reserves, became known as banknotes. An economic miracle had been performed. The issuance of paper claims greater than the gold at hand meant that the Bank of England was creating most of its money out of nothing, a practice that eventually became adopted by the other central banks in existence at the time of Rhodes's meeting with Rothschild, namely Swedish Riksbank, Banco de España, Banque de France, Bank of Finland, De Nederlandse Bank, Norges Bank, Österreichische Nationalbank, Danmark's Nationalbank, Banco de Portugal, National Bank of Belgium, Bank of Indonesia, German Reichsbank, Bulgarian National Bank, National Bank of Romania, Bank of Japan, and the National Bank of Serbia. Wealth by stealth. The Rothschild family took control of the Bank of England in 1815 by an act of stealth. At the Battle of Waterloo, Nathan Natty Rothschild, Lord Nathan Rothschild's grandfather, funded the British forces under the Duke of Wellington, while Jacob Rothschild funded the French army under Napoleon. Receiving preliminary news from his couriers that Wellington had won the battle, Natty Rothschild appeared at the London Stock Exchange in a feigned mood of depression and commenced selling his British war bonds. This started a chain reaction. Traders en masse unloaded their bonds at rock-bottom prices to buyers, who were shills from the Rothschild family. When news arrived that Wellington had actually won the battle, Natty had received a 20-to-1 return on his investment. This forced England, now the financial hub of the world, to set up a new Bank of England with the Rothschilds as principal shareholders.
Rothschild in America. The involvement of the Rothschilds in American history dates back to 1791, when the banking family became the principal shareholders of the First National Bank of the United States, thanks to the efforts of Alexander Hamilton, their agent in the Washington cabinet. America's first central bank produced the country's currency and became the sole provider of loans, all interest-bearing, to the federal government. By 1796, the American government had borrowed $8.2 million from the central bank, and prices on consumer goods rose by 72%. Mayor Amschel Rothschild, the head of the banking family, demanded partial payment of the loan, which the government, under Thomas Jefferson, could provide by selling all of its shares in First National. In this way, the bank became 100% privately owned, with 75% of its shares held by the Rothschilds and other foreign bankers. The War of 1812. In 1811, when the charter for First National was set to expire, Natty Rothschild, the new head of the family, issued this order. Either the application for renewal of the charter is granted, or the United States will find itself in a disastrous war. But the members of Congress refused to buckle under this threat and voted against renewal. The War of 1812 erupted because of Britain's attempts to restrict trade between the United States and France and the impression, the seizing and forcing into service, of U.S. seamen into the Royal Navy. The Rothschilds' role in creating such policies remains unknown. But the banking family, nevertheless, provided the British government with loans without interest for the war effort. At the end of the struggle, America may have won its second war of independence, but the country was left with a huge war debt of $105 million relative to a population of 8 million. Faced with this financial burden, Congress approved the creation of the Second Bank of the United States in 1816. To no one's surprise, the Rothschilds emerged as the major shareholders. The Second National Bank. Nicholas Biddle, the point man to James Rothschild, was appointed president of Second National, which opened a string of branches in every major city. These branches extended loans to businessmen, banks, farmers, and settlers who wished to purchase land in the American West. In 1819, the Second Bank drastically reduced the money supply. Loans were no longer available. Thousands of Americans suddenly discovered they were unable to pay off their bank debts. Farmers were forced into foreclosure. Businesses went belly up. Speculators and settlers lost their lands and savings. The widespread financial disaster and depression, which provoked popular resentment against banking and business enterprise, enabled the shareholders of Second National, namely the Rothschilds, to purchase enormous assets at greatly depressed prices. In 1828, Andrew Jackson ran for president with the slogan, "Jackson and No Bank." The slogan was in keeping with his plan to seize control of the currency and to end the profiteering of the Rothschilds. As soon as he assumed the oath of office, Jackson began to withdraw government money from the Second Bank and to deposit it in state banks. This action prompted the Rothschilds to contract the money supply and to create another depression. Jackson, who was known for his fiery temper, responded by swearing, "You are a den of thieves and vipers, and I intend to rout you out. If the people understood the rank injustices of our money and banking system, there would be a revolution before morning." Routing the Rothschilds. Rout the Rothschilds, Jackson did. On September 10, 1833, he revoked the charter for the Second Bank, 5 years before it was set to expire. In defense of his action, Jackson condemned the legislation that brought the bank into existence by saying, "The act seems to be predicated on an erroneous idea that the present shareholders have a prescriptive right to not only the favor, but the bounty of the government. For their benefit, does this act exclude the whole American people from competition in the purchase of this monopoly?
present stockholders and those inheriting their rights as successors be established a privileged order, clothed both with great political power and enjoying immense pecuniary advantages from their connection with government. Should its influence be concentrated under the operation of such an act as this, in the hands of a self-elected directory whose interests are identified with those of the foreign stockholders, will there not be cause to tremble for the independence of our country in war, controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and holding thousands of our citizens' independence? It would be more formidable and dangerous than the naval and military power of the enemy. It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government for selfish purposes, to make the rich richer and more powerful. Many of our rich men have not been content with equal protection and equal benefits, but have besought us to make them richer by acts of Congress. I have done my duty to this country.
On January 30th, 1835, Richard Lawrence, an English immigrant, attempted to shoot President Jackson in front of the Capitol building. His pistols misfired, and the president clubbed Lawrence to the ground with his cane. The would-be assassin was deemed mentally unsound and confined to an asylum for the criminally insane. Jackson said that the Rothschilds were responsible for the attempt on his life, and Lawrence insisted that he had been commissioned to commit the murder by a group of
powerful people in Europe.
The Money Cartel. Despite their setback in America, the Rothschilds continued their global expansion by establishing financial ties to such countries as Austria, Germany, Russia, Italy, France, Egypt, China, South Africa, India, New Zealand, and Australia. In the process, they established close relations with other Jewish banking families, including the Cohens, Warburgs, Schiffs, Kuhns, Loebs, Lazards, Lehmans, and Goldmans. These families worked together, shared resources, and engaged in joint business ventures. They shared a common Jewish heritage, maintained close social ties, and often intermarried. Natty Rothschild married the oldest daughter of Levy Barrett Cohen, a prominent London financier. Jacob Schiff, who had lived with the Rothschilds, moved to America and married the daughter of Solomon Loeb, the head of the Kuhn-Loeb banking dynasty. The two daughters of Marcus Goldman married the sons of Samuel Sachs to form Goldman Sachs. Paul Warburg left Hamburg for New York, where he married Nina Loeb, the daughter of Solomon Loeb. United by blood, marriage, and ethnicity, they provided funding to American businessmen and industrialists, including Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and J.P. Morgan. In this way, they created a money cartel that has become the most powerful force on planet Earth. A new alliance. Although they were Freemasons and members of the same social clubs in London, Rhodes was not acquainted with Lord Nathan Rothschild, even though the banker was the major shareholder of De Beers, one of the largest diamond mines in Kimberley. Lord Rothschild was not easily approachable. He was described by his contemporaries as aristocratic, haughty, fiercely conservative, and unbearably rude. Yet Rothschild was beguiled by Rhodes and provided him with the funding not only to purchase all the diamond mines in Kimberley, but also to develop what Rhodes called the simply endless gold fields that existed beyond the Limpopo River in Matabeleland. Rothschild's beguilement was coupled with his realization that Rhodes and his society could be instrumental in achieving the following objectives of his banking family. 1. The creation of a Jewish homeland, and 2. The reestablishment of a central bank in America. By November 1888, the relationship between the two men had grown so close that Rhodes drafted a new will in which he named Rothschild the sole beneficiary of his estate. This raises the question, why would Rhodes bequeath his fortune to the world's wealthiest financier? The answer resides in the codicil to the will, which instructed Rothschild to use the wealth accumulated by Rhodes to establish a British secret society as a counterpart to the Kimberley Club that Rhodes had set up in South Africa. The British secret society, which Rhodes dubbed the Society of the Elect, was to be modeled after the Society of Jesus, which St. Ignatius Loyola had established in 1544. And Rhodes, in the codicil, requested Rothschild to take the constitution of the Jesuits, if obtainable, and insert the English Empire for the Roman Catholic Church. A new Jesuit order. The Society of Jesus began in 1540, when six men under the leadership of Ignatius Loyola met in secret to create a religious military order devoted to waging war against unbelief and apostasy. The Jesuits were obliged to relinquish their individual wills so that they could be moved about like corpses by the provincial general. By the time of Loyola's death in 1556, the order had 3,500 members living in 130 houses in 18 countries and 100 colleges. Through Herculean efforts, the Society of Jesus had turned back much of the Protestant tide, recapturing much of Germany, most of Hungary and Bohemia, and all of Poland. The fact that the Jesuits accomplished so much in so little time convinced Rhodes that his secret society, thanks to modern advancements in transportation and communication, could produce even greater results. They could bring the most despicable specimens of human beings under the dominance of the English race and religion. This task was advanced by Rothschild, who attracted a host of influential aristocrats to the newly dubbed Society of the Elect, including Lord Reginald Balliol Brett, Queen Victoria's closest advisor, Lord Archibald Primrose, the 5th Earl of Rosebery, and Rothschild's son-in-law, who would serve as Britain's Prime Minister from 1894 to 1895, and Arthur James Balfour, 1st Earl of Balfour, who would become the British Prime Minister from 1902 to 1905. Rhodes's ties to these three men would become tightened by their shared homosexuality and their preference for burly, blue-eyed boys. Among the other recruits were Albert Lord Grey and Robert Armstrong Yates, two prominent members of the British Parliament, William Palmer, the 2nd Earl of Selborne, and Alfred Milner, Under-Secretary of Finance in Egypt. Milner, who was also of questionable sexual orientation, merits special mention. Rhodes recognized in him the kind of steel that was required to pursue the dream of world domination. "I support Milner absolutely, without reserve. If he says peace, I say peace. If he says war, I say war. Whatever happens, I say ditto to Milner." Riches beyond measure. Returning to Kimberley with funding from Rothschild, Rhodes purchased every diamond field in South Africa, including those owned by Barney Barnato, who had been one of his fiercest competitors. By 1889, he had gained control of 90% of the world's diamond trade and established the De Beers Consolidated Mining Company. Young men so smitten by their sweethearts that they pledged their troth by purchasing a tiny chip of crystalline carbon now, almost inevitably, contributed to the Rhodes fortune. Fortune continued to smile upon Rhodes. He bought up the farms of dirt-poor Boers outside Johannesburg. As luck would have it, a few hundred feet under the dirt, the world's richest and deepest seam of gold was unearthed. Thanks to Rothschild, Rhodes was granted a charter for his British South Africa company. The charter provided him with almost limitless power over vast tracts of unconquered lands, including Mashonaland and Matabeleland, a mass of land the size of Spain, France, and the Low Countries, which became known as Rhodesia, and the right to govern Bechuanaland, present-day Botswana, and Nyasaland, now known as Malawi. Rhodes was now rich beyond measure, and powerful enough to transform the course of human history. 4. The Lure of the Occult.
He, Cecil Rhodes, remained in the lodge because it gave him access to the money he needed to purchase the gold and diamond mines of southern Africa. If you study the lives of those who joined him, you will discover that most of them were either Freemasons, spiritualists, theosophists, or members of the Society of Psychical Research. Lord Milner was a 33rd degree Mason. William Stead was a spiritualist and a theosophist, and Arthur Balfour was a spiritualist, a Mason, and a member of the Society of Psychical Research. What most researchers have missed is the fact that most of the men who joined Cecil Rhodes' secret society were involved in the occult.
Stanley Monteith, Brotherhood of Darkness. During his trip to England to receive the charter for the British South Africa Company from Queen Victoria in 1889, Rhodes sought out William T. Stead, the editor of the Pall Mall Gazette, who had written an article stating that Britain and the United States should be reunited for the sake of world peace. Stead, who would emerge as a leading character in the saga of the Society of the Elect, was neither an aristocrat nor an Oxford graduate. The son of a Congregational minister, he became one of England's leading muckrakers. In 1885, Stead wrote a series of articles on child prostitution. To establish the truth of his revelations, he arranged to buy Eliza Armstrong, the 13-year-old daughter of a chimney sweep, for £5. Stead's purchase of the child led to his conviction for abduction and a well-publicized 3-month prison stay at Coldbath Fields and Holloway prisons. By the time he emerged from his jail cell, Stead had become the most famous journalist in England. At his 3-hour lunch meeting with Stead, Rhodes poured out the long, dammed-up flood of his ideas and offered Stead $2.5 million in today's money for a stake in the Gazette. The journalist was overwhelmed and later recorded the following in his journal.
"The talk concentrated presently upon the secret society, the society of the elect," Rhodes liked that word, "who were to bind themselves to work for the British Empire in the way in which the Jesuits worked for the Church of Rome. I telegraphed for Brett, who came 2 hours later, and we had a long talk, the net upshot of which was that the ideal arrangement would be, as far as we could see at present, Rhodes, general of the society, Stead, Brett, Milner to be the junta of three. After Rhodes, Stead to be general with a third who might be Rothschild in succession. Behind them, Manning, Booth, Little Johnson, Albert Gray, Arthur Balfour, to constitute a circle of initiates."
The Society of the Elect would be structured as circles within circles. The nucleus would consist of a junta of 3 or 4 individuals of power and wealth. The junta would chart the course of events that would culminate in a new world order. Surrounding this nucleus would be a circle of initiates. These initiates, while not privy to the decision-making process of the society, would be willing to follow the dictates of the junta without question. Finally, the society would be enclosed by an association of helpers who would constitute the broad mass of the organization. The helpers would work to make the dream of Cecil Rhodes a reality without concern of the inner machinations of the organization and the covert manner in which policy was adopted. This same organization would come to characterize the various offshoots of the Society of the Elect, including the Pilgrim Societies, the Round Table, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bank of International Settlements, the World Bank, and the Trilateral Commission. The Mowbray House Meeting. The names of several men who met in Stead's office at Mowbray House remain telling. Cardinal Henry Edward Manning was a member of the Oxford movement and the leading Roman Catholic prelate in England. During the London dock strike of 1889, where he became the principal mediator, the cardinal developed a close relationship with Stead. The appearance of his name among the circle of initiates signifies the society's belief that Manning could be highly instrumental in gaining the Vatican's approval of the formation of a global government, if not a one-world religion. General William Booth was a Methodist minister and the founder of the Salvation Army, which had established chapters in the United States, Canada, France, Switzerland, Sweden, India, the Cape Colony, Australia, and New Zealand. Booth had worked closely with Stead in revealing the wretched conditions of England's slums, and by 1890 had gained Rhodes's esteem. His name displays the belief by Stead and Rhodes that Booth could serve as Manning's Protestant counterpart in forging the New World Order. Little Harry Johnson, whom Rhodes had met in 1889 during his visit to London, had served for years in the British consular service for West Africa. Rhodes had sent Johnson on a mission to forge treatises with the African chiefs ruling from the Shire Highlands along the western shores of Lake Malawi to the southern tip of Lake Tanganyika. His success in this venture laid the foundation for the British colony of Nyasaland and granted Rhodes the assurance that the United States of Africa could be created. Common interests. At the Mowbray House, Rhodes agreed to advance the objectives of the Society of the Elect through the establishment of schools and universities, the acquisition of newspapers, the creation of lectureships, and the dispatch of emissaries of propaganda throughout the empire. The Society's original members shared much in common. Apart from Stead, they were personages of means who had been educated at Oxford or Cambridge. They were Masons, most members of the Apollo chapter. Even Manning, prior to receiving holy orders, had been a lodge member. They were imperialists who had been influenced by the thought of John Ruskin and his belief that the world must be reshaped into an aesthetically pleasing whole. They were social Darwinists who believed by the British people, by the process of natural selection, had evolved into the master race. With the exception of Stead, they held positions of political power that would impact the course of British affairs, and they all had cultivated strong ties to the Rothschild family. Even Manning, who had served as the governor of the Bank of England before becoming a prelate. Of equal importance was their interest in the occult. Rhodes and Rothschild shared an interest in the Jewish Kabbalah, a mystical interpretation of scripture based on the concealed meaning in its letters and words, and the mystery religions that flourished at the time of Christ. This interest resulted in Rhodes's belief in pre-existence and reincarnation. Arthur Balfour established the Society for Psychical Research in 1882, and the Synthetic Society in 1890. Both groups espoused the doctrine that departed spirits can communicate great truths. These revelations from the grave, they maintained, should be used to form the basis of a one-world religion. But of all the founders of the Society of the Elect, Stead was the most grounded in the dark arts. He was a well-known medium and a prominent member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. This closed society, founded by three Freemasons, specialized in esoteric philosophy, astrology, geomancy, astral travel, and alchemy. Stead was also a theosophist and a devout disciple of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. Rhodes came to share a similar interest in theosophy. The bookshelves of Krute Skuur, the Rhodes estate in Cape Town, South Africa, remain to this day weighed down with hundreds of works by Blavatsky and other theosophists, including Anne Besant, Henry Alcott, and Judge William Q. Nilakat. The sheer number of these books shows that Rhodes's interest in this subject had deepened into an obsession. The Worship of Satan. As espoused by Blavatsky, theosophy purports to reveal the ancient path to enlightenment and salvation on the basis of the teachings of Freemasonry. Her teachings, as expressed in the Secret Doctrine, are centered on the belief that Satan is the god of our planet and our only god. In this work, she writes, "Demon est Deus inversus, that is to say, through every point of infinite space thrill the magnetic and electrical currents of animate nature,
the life-giving and death-giving waves, for death on earth becomes life on another plane. Lucifer is divine and terrestrial light, the Holy Ghost, and Satan at one and the same time, visible space being truly filled with the differentiated breath invisibly. And the astral light, the manifested effects of the two who are one, guided and attracted by ourselves, is the karma of humanity, both a personal and impersonal entity. Personal because it is the mystic name given by St. Martin to the host of divine creators, guides and rulers of this planet. Impersonal as the cause and effect of universal life and death. The fall was the result of man's knowledge, for his eyes were opened. Indeed, he was taught wisdom and the hidden knowledge by the fallen angel, for the latter had become, from that day, his manas, mind and self-consciousness. In each of us, that golden thread of continuous life, periodically broken into active and passive cycles of sensuous existence on earth, and super-sensuous in Devachan, is from the beginning of our appearance upon this earth. It is the Sutratma, the luminous thread of immortal impersonal monadship, on which our earthly lives or evanescent egos are strung as so many beads, according to the beautiful expression of Vedantic philosophy. And now it stands proven that Satan, or the red fiery dragon, the lord of Phosphorus, brimstone was a theological improvement, and Lucifer, or light-bearer, is in us. It is our mind, our tempter and redeemer, our intelligent liberator and savior from pure animalism. Without this principle, the emanation of the very essence of the pure divine principle, Mahat, intelligence, which radiates direct from the divine mind, we would be surely no better than animals.
Blavatsky's disciples came to include Thomas Edison, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, author of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, poet William Butler Yeats, L. Frank Baum, author of The Wizard of Oz, Helen Keller, the subject of The Miracle Worker, Aleister Crowley, the father of modern Satanism, Adolf Hitler, Alice Bailey, the founder of Lucis Trust, the publishing arm of the United Nations, India's liberator Mahatma Gandhi, and Henry Wallace, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's vice president during World War II. The Theosophical Society, under Madame Blavatsky, established its headquarters in Madras, India, to fulfill a threefold purpose. 1. To promote universal brotherhood and world peace. 2. To encourage the study of comparative religion, and 3. To engage in a systematic investigation of the mystical powers of human beings who, through successive stages of reincarnation, may transform into gods. Although few members of the Society of the Elect upheld traditional biblical beliefs, they all believed that supernatural assistance was required to create a new world order. Small wonder, therefore, that they turned to a force that promised to provide them with the world and all its riches. 5. Boars and Blood.
If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and, which is more, you'll be a man, my son.
Rudyard Kipling, If, a paean for Cecil Rhodes and Leander Starr Jameson. In 1891, Rhodes became Prime Minister of the Cape Colony, a position he would hold for the next 5 years. Addressing the Cape Parliament, Rhodes proclaimed,
"If you were to sleep for 25 years, you might find a gentleman called your Prime Minister sitting in Cape Town and controlling the whole, not only to the Zambezi, but to Lake Tanganyika."
Now known as the Colossus, he initiated railway systems that ran from the Cape through the Orange State of the Boers and onto Johannesburg and from southern Matabele land to northern Mashonaland, Rhodesia. The dream that Rhodes expressed in his confession of faith was coming to fruition. Tens of thousands of British immigrants lured by reports of gold, including the location of the fabled King Solomon's Mines and the offer of free land, moved from the overpopulated cities of England to the lands owned and controlled by Rhodes in South Africa. Within the new country that Rhodes called Zambezi, the new settlers came to produce more wheat, maize, and tobacco than anywhere else save America. Beef cattle thrived in the lowlands north of Bulawayo, and fruit, apples, oranges, lemons, pears, peaches, apricots, pineapples, strawberries, coconuts, and melons grew in such prodigious quantity that the highly profitable Rhodes fruit farms came into existence. To unify the vast continent into one enormous country, Rhodes laid plans for a Cairo to Cape Town railroad, a train that would traverse the Zambezi with its mighty falls, run through the meandering Congo, scale massive mountains like Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya, stretch boundless savannas and vast deserts, and circle lakes the size of small seas. The jungles would be cleared. The timber would be transported on railroad cars to the cities that would sprout up at the railroad stations. The natives would be pushed from their lands in accordance with the Glen Grey Act, legislation that Rhodes initiated, and sent to work on the farms, factories, and industrial plants. This work, Rhodes believed, would assist the black natives in shedding their slovenly habits.
"It must be brought home to them," Rhodes said, "that in the future 9/10 of them will have to spend their lives in manual labor, and the sooner that is brought home to them, the better."
The inexhaustible minerals, iron ore, coal, copper, nickel, lead, bauxite, and gold of Africa, would be mined by the black labor force. Riches beyond measure would be added to the British Empire, and it all seemed well within the grasp of Cecil Rhodes in 1895, when Zambezia was renamed Rhodesia in his honor. The Boer problem. But before this venture got underway, matters within the Cape Colony remained to be settled. The discovery of seemingly limitless gold reserves in Witwatersrand brought thousands of Uitlanders, foreigners, to the Transvaal, which remained under the rule of the Boers, Dutch settlers. The foreigners, for the most part, came from Great Britain, Australia, and the United States. Few spoke Dutch or German, the dominant European languages in the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, and they were subjected to restrictions, including a 4-year residency in the Boer territories, before receiving the right to vote in public elections. The Uitlanders were also subjected to heavy taxes, including an onerous tax on dynamite that did not apply to Boers. Rhodes, believing that the situation in Johannesburg was on the verge of armed insurrection, organized an invasion of the Boer Republic under Sir Leander Starr Jameson. A physician by profession, Jameson was also a member of the Secret Society, a director of the British South Africa Company, a drunkard, a foolhardy adventurer, and one of Rhodes's sexual partners. If successful, the raid would have eliminated the two Boer republics, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, and enabled Rhodes to paint more of the dark continent a bright British red. It also would have represented a step toward the creation of a world federation of English-speaking dominions and allowed the Rothschilds to greatly increase their gold reserves. Power and pederasts. The mounting of the raid showed that the Society of the Elect had become, within a few short years of its existence, a formidable force. Thanks to the machinations of Lord Rothschild, Rhodes, who maintained a stable of angels and lambs, young boys to furnish his sexual needs, had gained his appointment as the Cape Colony's Prime Minister, and Archibald Primrose, the 5th Earl of Rosebery, a new member of the society, had become Britain's Prime Minister. Lord Rosebery had married Hannah Rothschild, the daughter of Mayor Amschild Rothschild II, in 1874. A notorious pederast, Rosebery was sheltered from scandal by his father-in-law, even when he was condemned of buggering the son of the Marquess of Queensbury. Reginald Brett, 2nd Viscount Esher, became permanent secretary to the Office of Works and Queen Victoria's closest adviser. Brett, too, engaged in pederasty and had a string of affairs with a host of Eton boys, including his own son, Morris. Arthur Balfour, yet another accused pederast and alleged sadomasochist, became First Lord of the Treasury. The Jameson Raid. On December 29, 1895, Sir Jameson set out for Johannesburg with a meager force of 494 men, including 400 members of the Matabeleland Mounted Police. He thought that this small army was sufficient to conquer the 17 districts of the Transvaal, since it was equipped with 18 Maxims, the first recoil-operated machine guns. "I will simply blow the Boers away," Jameson bragged to Frederick Hamilton, editor of the Johannesburg Star. "I shall draw a zone of lead a mile on each side of my column, and no Boer will be able to live in it." The Boers knew that the raid was coming. Armed with German Mauser rifles, they waited until Jameson and his column marched into a valley beneath the hills of Krugersdorp before opening fire. 30 of Jameson's men fell at once. 30 more, including Jameson and Frank Rhodes, Cecil's brother, were captured. The remainder retreated in disarray. Unexpected blowback. The effects of the debacle were immediate. Rhodes was forced to resign as Prime Minister and as chairman of the Charter Company. A heavy ransom for the prisoners was paid to the Transvaal by Rhodes and Alfred Beit. And Jameson was brought to England, where he was charged with mounting a military attack on a friendly state. He was sentenced to 15 months' imprisonment. Then came an unexpected blowback. Upon hearing the news of the raid, Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany sent a telegram to Paul Kruger, the president of the Transvaal, in which he said, "I express my sincere congratulations that, without calling on the aid of friendly powers, you and your people, by your own energy against the armed bands which have broken into your country as disturbers of the peace, have succeeded in re-establishing peace and defending the independence of the country against attacks from without." The cable caused such an uproar that the British people clamored for war against Germany. The Kaiser had congratulated Kruger for killing English settlers without mentioning a word about the plight of the Aplanders. Under mounting pressure, Queen Victoria sent this telegram to her grandson, Kaiser Wilhelm. "I cannot refrain from expressing my deep regret at the telegram you sent to President Kruger. It is considered very unfriendly towards this country, which I feel it is not intended to be, and has, I grieve to say, made a most unfavorable impression." The English hatred of Germany, provoked by the Kaiser's condemnation of Jameson, was a contributing cause to the outbreak of World War I. The raid lionized. Thanks to the cable, Rhodes regained the esteem of his countrymen, and Jameson became a folk hero. Alfred Austin's first published poem as Britain's Poet Laureate was a tribute to the leader of the raiders called Jameson's Ride. It appeared in the Times of London on January 11, 1896, and opened with these words.
"Wrong. Is it wrong? Well, maybe. But I'm going, boys, all the same. Do they think me a burgher's baby, to be scared by a scolding name? They may argue and prate and order. Go, tell them to save their breath. Then over the Transvaal border and gallop for life or death. Let lawyers and statesmen addle their pates over points of law.
If sound be our sword, and saddle, and gun gear, who cares one straw? When men of our own blood pray us to ride to their kinsfolk's aid, not heaven itself shall stay us from the rescue they call a raid.
In the wake of the raid, the Boers, thanks to the Germans, became armed to the teeth, and Alfred Milner, thanks to Lord Rothschild, became the new governor of the Cape Colony. The gold of Witwatersrand could be left to the Dutch, and so a war was rigged. The rigging was made possible not only by the Milner appointment, but also by Jan Smuts, a prominent Boer who had graduated from Cambridge. Smuts was a vigorous supporter of Rhodes and had acted for many years as his agent in Kimberley. In 1898, he settled in the Transvaal and became the state secretary and the chief political advisor to President Kruger. As soon as Smuts was in place, Milner ordered provocative troop movements on the Boer frontier. In keeping with the script, the movements persisted until Smuts drew up an ultimatum, which threatened war if the threatening troop activity persisted. Milner rejected the ultimatum and Kruger declared war on October 9, 1899. The conflict was, as G. Edward Griffin writes in The Creature from Jekyll Island,
an act of careful engineering
by Milner, Rothschild, and the Society of the Elect on both sides, British and Boer.
One making outrageous demands and the other responding to those demands in pretended indignation.
In the first weeks of fighting, the British suffered casualties that exceeded 3,000. In 1902, by the time the conflict came to an end, 7,582 British soldiers had been killed in action, 13,139 died of disease, 40,000 were wounded, and one had been eaten by a crocodile. 6,000 Boers were killed in action, while 26,000 white civilians and 17,182 African natives died of disease and starvation in concentration camps that had been set up in the Cape and Orange River colonies. The war had salubrious results for Rhodes and Milner, including the incorporation of the Transvaal and the Orange Free State into the British Empire. Disregard the screamers. When Stead expressed his outrage at the war in an article that appeared in the Review of Reviews, Rhodes chastised his journalistic friend as follows.
That is the case which will be fatal to our ideas, insubordination. Do not you think that it is very disobedient of you? How can our society be worked if each sets himself up as the sole judge of what ought to be done? Just look at our position here. We three are in South Africa. All of us, your boys, I myself, Milner and Garrett, all of whom learned politics from you. We are on the spot, and we are unanimous in declaring this war to be necessary. You have never been in South Africa, and yet, instead of deferring to the judgment of your own boys, you fling yourself in violent opposition to the war.
However, Milner had the grace to confess his role in the war.
I precipitated the crisis, which was inevitable, before it was too late,
he wrote in a letter to Lord Frederick Roberts.
It is not very agreeable, and in many eyes not very creditable, piece of business to have been largely instrumental in bringing about a big war.
However, the 20,000 children who had died in the British concentration camps were of little consequence to Milner. When faced with criticism about the atrocities, Milner responded,
If we are to build up anything in South Africa, we must disregard and absolutely disregard the screamers.
6. So little done, so much to do.
The fact that Rhodes awarded the United States so many more scholarships than were given to all the colonies put together showed how much importance he still attached to the Anglo-American partnership. He never wholly abandoned the hope that the United States might one day rejoin the empire. He realized that this would have to be more of a merger than a takeover, and was even prepared to accept the possibility
that the balance of power might one day shift so far that Washington, rather than London, would become the seat of government. Philip Ziegler, Legacy, Cecil Rhodes, The Rhodes Trust, and Rhodes Scholarships. During his final years, Rhodes's symptoms of obsessive compulsion became more and more pronounced. He drank prodigious amounts of booze, champagne, beer, and bourbon from morning to night. He shaved so often that he removed layers of skin from his face. After each shave, he would soak in a tub, drink in hand, for several hours. Following this ritual, he would roam about his estate, stark naked, in the company of his angels and lambs. Keir Hardie, leader of Britain's Labour Party, labelled him
a confirmed drunkard and dipsomaniac.
His thoughts began to focus more and more on the United States. Stead observed,
"He, Rhodes, was devoted to the old flag, the Union Jack. But in his ideas he was an American, and in his latter years he expressed to me his unhesitating readiness to accept the reunion of the English race under the Stars and Stripes, if it could not be obtained in any other way. Although he had no objection to the monarchy, he unhesitatingly preferred the American to the British Constitution, and the textbook which he laid down for his novitiates was a copy of the American Constitution."
Rhodes believed that the unification of Britain and the United States would secure
the peace of the world for all eternity, and the creation of a universal language.
This merger could be effected, Rhodes argued, by the strengthening of economic trade between the two nations, trade unencumbered by tariffs,
by the planting of pilgrim societies in London and New York,
where American and British bankers, businessmen and industrialists could meet in private to outline their joint goals and objectives, and by the awarding of Rhodes scholarships to Oxford University for the best and brightest American students so that they could play an integral part in the formation of the New World Order. Once sufficient support for the merger was achieved, he believed, the British House of Commons would unite with the U.S. Congress for the formation of an imperial parliament, the members of which would remain seated for 5-year terms, alternating their location between London and Washington, D.C. The last days. By the early months of 1902, Rhodes's health deteriorated rapidly. He was only 48 years old, but looked decades older. His failing heart had left him gasping for breath and racked with pain. Compounding his misery was the oppressive heat of that summer. During the daytime, Rhodes stayed at Crutasker, but when evening came, he retreated to a small cottage on the seafront, at Meisenberg, where he sought relief from breezes blowing off False Bay. One of his aides, Gordon LeSueur, recalled,
"Rhodes would wander about the house like a caged animal, his clothes all thrown open, his hand thrust characteristically inside his trousers, the beads of perspiration glistening on his forehead, beneath his tousled hair as he panted for breath. Into the darkened drawing-room he would go and fling himself upon a couch. Then he would start up and huddle himself up in a chair, and anon painfully toil upstairs to his bedroom and pace to and fro, every now and then stopping at the window, which gave him that wondrous view of Table Mountain."
A great example. The end came on March 26, 1902. Jameson, who remained with Rhodes to the end, reported his last words as follows.
"So little done. So much to do."
Over the Easter weekend, some 30,000 people filed through Crutasker to view the catafalque. On Monday, the coffin was moved to the Parliament in Cape Town, where thousands more came to pay their respects. The next day, it was transported from Parliament on a gun carriage draped with a Union Jack to a funeral service at the Anglican Cathedral. For his eulogy, the Archbishop of Cape Town used 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 38, as his text.
"Know ye not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel. He urged the congregation to follow Rhodes's great example and dedicate their lives to the expansion and consolidation of the British Empire, to the provision of new markets for British merchandise, and to a new country for British colonists.
No mention was made of his disdain for Christianity, his hedonistic lifestyle, or his treatment of natives. Then, in another procession, the coffin was taken to the railway station for a journey to the north. On April 10th, a memorial service was held at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. The occasion provided proof that the assassination of Uncle Sam already was in the works. Seated with Lord Rothschild was J.P. Morgan. Among the others who packed into the cathedral were General William Booth, Mr. and Mrs. William Stead, Sir Arthur Balfour, and Albert Lord Grey, who became one of the trustees of the Rhodes Scholarships. Post-mortem. Lord Milner assumed leadership of the Society of the Elect, which he renamed the Round Table. Under his direction, hundreds of prominent British statesmen, writers, and bankers were recruited to the secret society, including Sir Patrick Duncan, Governor-General of South Africa, Philip Henry Kerr, 11th Marquess of Lothian, and the British Ambassador to America, 1st Baron Robert Henry Brand, Managing Director of the House of Lazard in England, Lionel Curtis, Professor of Colonial History at Oxford University, George Geoffrey Dawson, Editor of the London Times, John Buchan, 1st Baron Tweedsmuir, author of the 39 Steps and future Governor-General of Canada, T. E. Lawrence, one of the first Rhodes Scholars, who would become known as Lawrence of Arabia, Leo Amery, Britain's colonial secretary, Stanley Baldwin, 1st Earl Baldwin of Bewdley, who would serve as Prime Minister of England under three monarchs, Sir Edward Peacock, a partner at Barings Bank and a director of the Bank of England, and Rudyard Kipling, the first English-language writer to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. Before the group, Milner gave the following address in 1905.
What I pray for hardest is that those with whom I have worked in a great struggle and who may attach some weight to my words should remain faithful, faithful above all in the period of reaction to the great idea of imperial unity. When we who call ourselves imperialists talk of the British Empire, we think of a group of states, all independent in their local concerns, but all united for the defense of their own common interests and the development of a common civilization. United not in an alliance, for alliances can be made and unmade, and are never more than nominally lasting, but in a permanent, organic union. Of such a union, the dominions as they exist today are, we fully admit, only the raw material. Our ideal is still distant, but we deny that it is either visionary or unattainable. The road is long, the obstacles are many, the goal may not be reached in my lifetime, perhaps not in that of any man in this room. You cannot hasten the slow growth of a great idea like that by any forcing process. But what you can do is keep it steadily in view, to lose no opportunity to work for it, to resist like grim death any policy which leads away from it. I know that the service of that idea requires the rarest combination of qualities, a combination of ceaseless effort with infinite patience. But then think, on the other hand, of the greatness of the reward, the immense privilege of being allowed to contribute in any way to the fulfillment of one of the noblest conceptions which has ever dawned on the political imagination of mankind.
Milner's period of stewardship in South Africa proved to be of significant consequence. He administered the defeated Transvaal and Orange Free State as occupied territories and recruited into the upper layers of his civil service a band of young men from well-to-do, upper-class, frequently titled families who became known as Milner's Kindergarten. They replaced the governors, administrators, and bureaucrats of the Boer republics and worked to rebuild the broken country. The kindergarten comprised new blood, young